China's new open-door policy has opened the door to capitalism, pop music, Western movies, fashion, cosmetic surgery, and luxury golf resorts. China's love-hate relationship with the West is the subject of Orville Schell's new book, Discos and Democracy. Schell has been reporting from China off and on since 1975. He's written several books, as well as articles for such magazines as The New Yorker, The Atlantic, and Rolling Stone. In Discos and Democracy, Schell offers many examples of how China is changing. One of them is an article he saw in the China Daily, headlined, "Don't Be Afraid of Democracy." I asked him about the point of the article.
Well, I think the point was that when this article appeared in China, it was during this amazing few months when, in 1986 in the fall, when people throughout China were just sort of bubbling with this discussion about the role that democracy might play in Chinese life. So this was a kind of an expression of this wonderful coming alive, this warming up of the political climate.
Yeah, and the article said that, you know, in the past, democracy had been equated with bourgeois values, but we shouldn't completely dismiss democracy.
Well, you know, it's sort of a whole package, democracy, capitalism, you know, pop culture, and the Chinese have long had this sense, or this hope, perhaps would be a better way to put it, that you could kind of borrow discreetly from the West, that you could borrow technology or borrow aspects of an economic system, and that you wouldn't have bled into this discrete borrowing all these other values and ideas. And, of course, many other things have drifted into China along with such new ideas as democracy. And the Communist Party doesn't quite know how to deal with it, whether to try to banish them, to accept them, to take off pieces of them. And it's this welter of new and fascinating and highly seductive ideas, values, music, literature, political notions that have now just entered what once was a kind of a very one-dimensional situation.
I think one of the main points of your book is that when China opened its doors to the West, popular culture came in, American popular culture came in. And one of the things that's interesting to me is that it's not always the best stuff that came in. I think one of my favorite parts of your book is you sitting, I think it was on a plane in China, listening to Muzak versions of Vaya con Dios and Puff the Magic Dragon, I Felt for You.
Well, I mean, that's the paradox of freedom, isn't it? I mean, exactly the paradox that communist countries have not wanted to wrestle with and are very ill-equipped to wrestle with, namely that with the good comes the bad. And so at the same time, one can be in China and be horrified by the kind of kitsch that comes in, the worst, for instance, kinds of disco, this kind of knockoff Chinese disco. At the same time, one is sort of electrified by the idea that China is becoming somewhat freer, more open. But when that door opens to the West, even a crack, I mean, it's like a tidal wave crashes in. And, you know, the difference between now and China and 10, 12, 15 years ago is that whereas once America was reviled, now it is exactly the opposite. It is the symbol of everything wonderful, exciting. But, of course, the slavish worship and this creating a fantasy of the West is just as sort of unrealistic as creating the opposite fantasy of the United States as a pit of bourgeois values and United States as the imperialist, capitalist enemy of the masses of the world.
When the first few times you went to China, there were a lot of political songs and political slogans that were used, and you make it seem like a lot of those have disappeared, but maybe you can, you'll hate me for this. Would you sing one of the political songs that used to be really popular?
Oh, that's amazing. You know, I wish I actually, somebody ought to collect these songs, you know, that songs about all the followers of Chairman Mao being little sunflowers, and there's one wonderful song called Socialism is Good. This is just a wonderful song because it's so simple, and you talk to Chinese now about the days when they were singing these songs, and they kind of laugh uproariously, and yet they were involved in it. You know, it was an era where there was no ambiguity, where people were unambivalent about what was happening. They were surging forward with these wonderfully defiant and uncomplicated looks of sort of socialist ardor on their face. But, you know, alas, that era is over, and China has been thrown into a three-dimensional universe once again, where people are forced to deal with all the complex questions that everyone else in the world is forced to deal with. And I think there's going to be a big nostalgia industry in China soon for those days when things were uncomplicated, people believed, values were clear, and the revolution hadn't canceled itself, you know, with all these leaders indulging in intrigues and power struggles and leaving the country just sort of bereft of belief and quite cynical.
You know, one of the things I find interesting about China is that it's become this place for people to project their fantasies. Those fantasies might be about the perfect egalitarian society, or about the Red Menace, or about spiritual wisdom. But everybody seems to have something to project onto China. Do you find that yourself?
Yeah, I think it's very true. I mean, we look back to the 60s, where in this country in Europe, I mean, during all the student uprisings, people had really did take China as a model. And that's because, theoretically speaking, it makes a lot of sense. What we missed, of course, was the way in which that revolution was failing to deliver on the theory. I think it's true also in this kind of cosmic sense that people love to imbue China with this idea of being this spiritual, deeply spiritual land. In fact, I can't think of any country in the world right now which is sort of less spiritual than China. And I think that's one of the sad facts of the Chinese Revolution, that in turning on old culture, it not only destroyed traditions of the past, but it also canceled China's identity. So people in China have a very little sense about not only what to believe in, but who they are, what it means to be Chinese. And I think it doesn't bode well for the future, because any country which sort of loses its mooring and tries to reestablish some sense of itself by borrowing and casting around is a highly unstable one. And in the meanwhile, it allows us from the West to project on to it whatever we wish, since it is, in a sense, nothing clear and anything and everything to anyone who wants to make it so.
Are you glad that you can go to China in the capacity of a book author and journalist, and that you can write in a fairly breezy first person kind of style about it, as opposed to a more formal analysis of the politics and economy of China?
Yes, because I think if there's anything China has lacked, and the Chinese Revolution has lacked, it's the kind of a notion of it as a country which is made up of people whose lives are, you know, triumphs and tragedies. We've had so much of China as political movements, as sort of sociological phenomena, and it's been such a difficult country to get to know in any deeply personal way. So that I try always to somehow convey that sense and not just treat it as a board game of, you know, sides washing back and forth across the country waged in sort of political combat.
Have your experiences in China influenced the way you live in America?
Well, I'll tell you, I think they have, in the sense that I find myself ever more appreciative of what the kinds of lives that we are able to live here, both from the standpoint of the enormous wealth we have, but also, and I really underline this, the incredible freedom we have. I think, you know, finally it's this that is so seductive about us. And I wish that the people in Washington, that the powers that be, would understand how powerful we actually are as a model, you know, as a kind of seductive culture, as a political system that really needs no Marines, needs no, military actions to persuade others. Once Nixon went there and China began to get a glimpse of the West, the rest followed almost automatically, until now we're in the embarrassing situation of not needing to sell ourselves anymore, but in fact warning the Chinese, you know, slow down, you know, don't go too far overboard, find your own balance, don't be too ready just to grab everything Western.
So you think rock and roll and movies have more power than the U.S. military, huh?
Oh, boy, I think that is the understatement of the century.
Well, Rochelle, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Orville Schell's new book, Discos and Democracy, is published by Pantheon. He spoke to us from station KQED in San Francisco. This is Fresh Air.